table with trays of liquid. An acrid, chemical odor filled the air. A clothesline held drying prints and long strips of negatives, which curled from the bottom. When Marco's eyes adjusted, he crossed to Corrado, who stood at an enlarger, shedding a cone of white light on a sheet of photographic paper.
Corrado, I'm Marco Terizzi.
So? Corrado flicked off the white light, plunging them both into darkness except for the orange lamp. My family owns Bar Girosport, and you take pictures of the customers in the outside seating area. Were you there Thursday afternoon?
I'm usually there, until your father makes me go.
I need to see the pictures you took that afternoon.
I only develop the negatives. I don't make prints unless somebody orders them, and nobody did.
Then let me see the negatives.
It'll cost you.
Corrado slid the photographic paper from the machine, crossed the darkroom to the trays of chemicals, and slid the paper into the liquid.
If you want any prints, that'll cost you too.
I'll pay, but you have to do it right now.
You'll pay for that too. Rush jobs are extra.
Fine.
Corrado turned away and started riffling through negatives hanging from the ropes. The stiff strips made a crinkling sound as they swung into each other. He stopped at one.
This roll is from that day, I believe.
Can I see it?
Marco stepped over, squinting in the darkness, and Corrado unclipped the strip of negatives and handed it to him, holding it by the edges.
Don't smudge it in case I get a call. I give out cards with my number, and sometimes they change their minds.
Okay.
Marco took the negative strip, and Corrado handed him a photographer's loop.
Go in the vestibule outside. There's a light box there. You can look for yourself.
Thank you.
Marco went to the vestibule, where there was a skinny table with a light box on top. He located a switch on the box, and it came to glowing life. He placed the negative strip on the box, which illuminated the images in obverse, with white spaces where there was darkness and vice versa. Marco placed the loop on top of the strip, and the images zoomed into magnified focus. The first few were photos of random women on the street, then couples at sidewalk cafes. He kept going until Tiber Island appeared, then the Piazza San Bartolomeo all'Isola. Toward the end of the strip were images from the seating area in front of Bar Girosport. Marco's heart began to pound. The first image was of an older couple, and the second of a family smiling at the camera. The third was a shot of a pretty girl passing by, and in the background was an empty table in the seating area. He wondered if it was where the blonde anti-fascist had been sitting before she was in the stockroom with Aldo. Marco moved the loop to the next frame. It was a picture of another pretty girl passing the bar, but in the background was a clear photo of the blonde, taken as she was emerging from the bar. Marco felt a surge of relief. He could prove his loyalty and his innocence. The blonde's face was fully visible, and the photo of her, once enlarged, could even be used to identify her. He eyed her through the loop, and her face stared back at him, spooky in the obverse, as if her head were a skull. He knew that once he identified her, she would be arrested and beaten for information. Marco paused, reflecting. Aldo would want him to protect the blonde, not turn her in. But Marco felt a flame of anger, too. The blonde had manipulated Aldo. She had sent him to Orvieto for guns. Aldo would be alive but for her and her ilk. Marco had to think of himself, too. He needed to clear his name, to get his job back. He had bet his future on the party. He made a decision.
Corrado,
he called out, flicking off the light box.
Chapter 42. Elisabetta, November 1938. Elisabetta hurried into the ghetto, hoping to see Sandro. She felt sure he had been avoiding her. He had been teaching at the Jewish school, and she would stop by to see him after class. But he would always say he was too busy. She couldn't let another day pass without seeing him. Elisabetta hurried along the street, reaching the school. Children of all ages gathered at the entrance, a gaggle of boys and girls with book bags and scarves. She spotted Sandro at the top of the steps, with the other teachers, and her heart gladdened. He looked handsome in a brown tweed jacket, white shirt, and brown tie, like a professor. "Sandro!" Elisabetta called out. And Sandro turned in her direction. He saw her, and their eyes connected. A pained expression flickered across his face, and he went back inside the school, disappearing. She hurried to the steps, climbed them two by two, and hustled inside, spotting him at the end of the hall. He went into a classroom, and she followed. She ran to the end of the hall and entered the classroom, which was a cramped room barely big enough for tables that had been repurposed for desks, with old chairs. Mismatched bookcases lined the left wall, and on the right were two windows that shed a cold light.
"Sandro, I want to talk."
"No." Sandro stood at an old teacher's desk, taking a thick packet of papers from his rucksack. "I can't. I'm busy."
"You say that every time."
"Because it's true."
"I don't know why you're avoiding me."
Elisabetta crossed to him, touching his arm. Up close, she could see that he had lost weight and his expression was drawn. "I'm not avoiding you." Sandro pursed his lips.
"You are? What is it? Is it something I've done? Is it because of Marco?"
"No, no." Sandro looked away.
"I've been thinking of you so much. I miss you."
"There's no time for that anymore. I have too much to do, and I can't hear about how you miss me."
"I'm not here for me. I'm here for you. I know how much you're hurting. I can see it in your eyes."
Sandro averted his gaze again, his feet shifting. "Elisabetta, what of it? You can't do anything about it."
"I can listen and be with you."
"That doesn't change anything."
"But it helps."
Elisabetta's heart went out to him.
"Remember after the Delada lecture, when we talked? I told you everything about my father, and you listened. It didn't change my father, but it helped me. And after my father's funeral, too. We always talk, and it makes things easier and better."
"That's past, and everything's changed. My world has changed. My father is losing his clients. My mother is exhausted. Rosa left for London. Cornelia is gone. Everything is different."
"Not us. We're still us."
"People change. People betray you." Sandro's expression turned pinched, and a new bitterness edged his tone. "There's a divide between Jews and everyone else now. The walls of the ghetto may as well be back up again. You're on the other side. You don't understand."
"So explain it to me. Tell me how you're feeling. Tell me what it's like."
Elisabetta felt her eyes fill with tears, but she held them off because they were his to cry, not hers.
"First getting thrown out of school, then this new law."
"The one that says there's no intermarriage."
"Yes. Everything about the law is wrong. All of it."
"I don't have the same rights as everybody else anymore. I can't marry anyone I want. I can't marry a Gentile. You're officially my better."
Elisabetta felt stricken. "No, don't say that. It's not true. I'm not, and the law doesn't matter to me."
"Of course it does. It's the law."
"The law doesn't matter between us."
Elisabetta held his gaze.
"The law wasn't here a month ago, and who knows whether it will be here a month from now.
I do, and it will.
You don't know that.
Elisabetta didn't know how to reach him, or even if she could.
You don't know what the future holds. It could be better.
It could be worse.
I'm saying the law is only politics. It will come and go. But these feelings we have for each other, they're not going away. They're here. I'm here for you.
What does that mean?
I love you,
Elisabetta answered, meaning it with all of her heart.
I love you, and I will love you when this law passes, and when we get older, and whatever else happens or whatever time brings.
You mean you're choosing me?
Sandro blinked.
Not Marco?
Yes. It's you, Sandro. It was always you.
Your timing is impeccable, Elisabetta. Just when you can't have me, you want me. Sandro frowned, shaking his head. The irony is too much. The law forbids it. My parents forbid it, and none of that matters to me.
Elisabetta stepped closer, resting her hand on his arm.
It does to me. This ends.
It never ends. It goes on and on. It's love.
Not anymore. Not for me. I don't feel the same as I used to about you. Not anymore.
Sandro straightened, setting his jaw.
I'm sorry.
Elisabetta's chest tightened.
You're just saying that?
No, I mean it.
Sandro regarded her, a chill in his blue eyes.
You made a choice, but I have one too.
Sandro, do you really mean this?
Elisabetta asked, her heart breaking.
Yes, I do.
Sandro glanced at the door, and the clamor of students echoed in the hallway.
My class is coming back. Please, don't make a scene.
I'm begging you. Give us a chance.
No, Elisabetta. You need to go.
Elisabetta ran from the classroom, wiping tears from her eyes, and hurried down the hallway past the students. Her heart was in tumult, her gut wrenched. She loved him, but she had decided too late. It was all her fault. Sandro was lost to her now. Elisabetta ran from the school and hurried through the ghetto, holding back her tears. She ran to Trastevere, reached the house and flew inside, avoiding Nonna's bedroom downstairs. She raced upstairs and ran to her bedroom, where she collapsed on the floor, finally letting the tears flow.
Chapter 43. Sandro, November 1938. Sandro sat at the table, too nervous to grade papers. His mother gazed out the window, undoubtedly feeling the same way. The first course of dinner, concha di fiori di zucca, fried squash flowers, cooled aromatically on the table. His father was late, and Sandro knew it would drive his mother more crazy than usual, for good reason. A white envelope sat on the table, still sealed, having been delivered in the day's mail. The return address was the Demorazza, which was the government agency that administered the race laws, so the envelope must contain the agency's decision on their family's exemption. His father had filed an application for one on their behalf, and they all hoped the exemption would be granted. They had been awaiting the decision and prayed that the agency went their way. Sandro would have opened the envelope rather than sit in suspended animation and guess about its contents. But his mother believed the envelope was his father's to open. So they waited. His mother smoothed out her dark sheath, fiddled with her pearl necklace, and linked her elegant hands in front of her. He put away his papers in silence, giving up on getting anything done. The fate of his family lay within the envelope. If they weren't granted an exemption from the race laws, they would lose their house, for Jews could no longer own property under those laws. His father would lose his law practice too, as Jews could no longer own businesses either. If his father couldn't work, it would cut their family income. Worse, it would break his parents' hearts to lose a house that had been in the family for generations. Sandro sighed. Unfortunately, even if they were awarded the exemption, it would not readmit him to school, because the exemptions applied only to the property provisions of the law. Nor would it permit him to marry Elisabetta, whom he thought about all the time. He still couldn't believe that she had chosen him over Marco, and it was his dream come true. But it had come too late. He had sent her away for her own good. He had lied to her when he'd told her that he didn't love her anymore. Of course, he still loved her, he always would. But he was no longer a suitable husband for her. He had no job, no prospects, and he couldn't even marry her anymore. Ironically, he loved her too much to tell her so, which left him miserable and aching, experiencing an odd sort of grief that mourned even the living. His mother reached for the letter and held it up to the chandelier, trying to read through the envelope.
"I can't see what it says. Mamma, just open it." "No, your father wants to be the one, and I told him we would honor his wishes."
His mother set the envelope down.
"It will be his triumph."
"I hope so. I think we'll get the exemption," his mother said, as if reassuring them both.
"He was practically a fascist of the first hour, an officer in the Great War, and he serves the community."
"I'm sure we'll get it," Sandro said, though he wasn't sure. "I'm sorry it won't permit your return to school."
"It's okay," Sandro said,
though the opposite was true.
"How are you enjoying the Jewish school?"
Sandro knew the correct answer.
"I like teaching, and it's good to contribute to the community. But I'm sure you miss your friends and working for the professor."
"Life is trade-offs." His mother paused.
"That's what I always say."
"I know. That's why I said it." Sandro smiled. His mother smiled back, her sharp eyes regarding him behind her glasses.
"I wonder if that means you're listening, or you've stopped listening."
"It means I'm listening.
How's Marco?"
"He's fine, working a lot." His mother paused again.
"And Elisabetta? How is she?"
"Fine, I assume. I don't see her. I'm not interested in her anymore."
"Oh?"
His mother blinked, her expression softening.
"I hope you understood our objection."
"I do, but I don't agree with it."
"Even after this? These awful race laws codify a ban against intermarriage."
His mother gestured at the white envelope, but Sandro couldn't suppress the resentment flaring in his chest.
"Mamma, if anything, that should make you question your view." "What are you talking about? The race laws prove the necessity for standing together as Jews. Our community is under dire threat."
"I choose not to discriminate against those who discriminate. It's a principled—"
"Oh, Sandro, fine," his mother snapped. "You're too smart by half, and I don't want to fuss. Do we need more upset? Should I have more worries than whatever is in that envelope?"
"So let's open it then." Sandro picked up the envelope, annoyed.
"If you won't, I will." "No, Sandro, don't. I forbid it."
His mother reached for the envelope just as Sandro jerked his hand away. The envelope tore in two, leaving her holding one half and him the other. In that moment, the front door opened and his father entered, smiling until he realized that Sandro and his mother were fighting. His father set down his briefcase and hurried into the dining room.
"What's going on, you two?" he asked, mystified. "What's that paper?"
"It's from the Demorazza."
His mother slid the other half of the envelope from Sandro's grasp and handed them both over.
"I'm sorry."
"Papa, I'm sorry too," Sandro said quickly.
"It's my fault. I wanted to open it, and Mamma said we shouldn't.
What have you done? This is an important legal document.
Appalled, his father slid the white paper from the left and right halves of the envelope, then placed both sides on the table, matching them up. His mother stood over his father's left shoulder, and Sandro came around his right. He looked down to see that the halves of the document were unevenly matched, but the ruling was legible and horrifying.
Negato,
read the handwritten scroll in capital letters.
No, his father said, hushed.
His mother gasped. Sandro felt stricken. His father moved both halves of the paper up and down, trying to realign them as if it would change the outcome.
No, 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 he said, over and over. Oh, no.
His mother put a hand on his father's knobby shoulder, but his father didn't seem to notice.
They would not deny us. They would not do this to us. They would not do this to me.
His father kept rearranging the two halves of the decision.
I'm almost a fascist of the first hour. I've done everything I can for the party. It would not do this to my family. It would not do this to me.
Massimo, please.
His mother patted his father's back.
We will find a way.
Il Duce would not do this to me, my country.
His father looked up, shaking his head, his eyes wild and his lips trembling. Sandro felt alarmed, having never seen his father so frantic. Tears came to his mother's eyes, and she edged away, as unsettled as he was. Sandro realized he had to do something. He took his father by the shoulders and turned him so they faced each other.
Papa, we have to reason together, the way we always do. We can figure out what to do.
We can't. We can't. We're ruined. I don't know what to do.
Sandro felt taken aback, but masked his dismay.
Can we appeal? Is there a provision for appeal of these rulings, like a regular court case?
No, no, no. Nothing like that's in the law. The decisions are final.
His father looked at Sandro without really seeing him, or so it seemed to Sandro.
Papa, let's think. There has to be some way to deal with this, and we will.
I've gotten exemptions for so many others. How could they deny mine? Why would they deny mine? Why?
Are you sure it's final, even though it's just handwritten? It barely looks official. I'm wondering if it's some sort of notation or...
No, no, it's a final determination. Many of them are handwritten denials. They're mere functionaries who decide these things. They're not lawyers, they're bureaucrats. They scribble.
His father started shaking his head again.
Perhaps I was a borderline case in that I didn't join the party until 1923, and that's before 1924, when they opened the rolls again. But why would they rely on such a technicality? How could they turn against one of their own? It's a fascist body deciding against one of the most loyal fascists in the community, in all of Rome. They have granted so many other exemptions, ones that I wrote, that were far less deserving. How could they deny us? This is a disaster.
So there's no way out under the law?
No.
Sandro's mind raced. What about outside of the law?
What do you mean?
I think there's a way, Sandro said, taking over.
Chapter 44. Beppe, November 1938. Beppe was relieved to show the last of the customers out of the bar. He was ready for bed, always exhausted lately, for he mourned Aldo so deeply. His grief weighed him down, but he bore it privately, a father's burden. Sometimes he felt as if he would collapse of its weight. Other times it reminded him of his time in the Great War. He had served in the 3rd Division of the Bersaglieri, an infantry unit of elite cyclists who carried not only a rucksack, but also a bicycle on their backs. He had been on the Isonzo front in the snowy Dolomites, and at Caporetto, a brutal defeat that still caused him nightmares. The Battle of Caporetto was infamous for its desertions, but Beppe had fought on, day after day, battling the enemy and his own despair. He felt the same way, grieving Aldo. As he finished cleaning up, he racked his brain for what he had done wrong with Aldo. How he had missed so many signs. Why his middle son had betrayed his country. Beppe felt as if he hadn't even known the boy, his own beloved child. He would never have believed that Aldo would resort to violence for any reason, much less against his own government. He had failed Aldo as a father. Beppe gathered a dirty napkin and took it to the counter. Marco looked up from cleaning the coffee machine, but said nothing. Since the fist fight at Aldo's funeral, he and Marco spoke only when they had to. Beppe experienced the rift between them as another loss, depressing him further. His wife, Maria, had taken to bed, and neither remedio nor prayer could console her. The Terrizzis had never been so miserable, and Beppe bore that as his failure, too. The happiness of a man's family was his responsibility, no less than putting food on the table. He was heading to the door to lock up when he saw Massimo and Sandro hurrying over the Ponte Fabrizio toward the bar. It was an unusual hour for a visit, but Beppe waved to them, and Massimo waved back. When the Simones reached the foot of the bridge, Beppe opened the door to welcome them.
Buonasera, Massimo, Sandro.
Massimo and Sandro greeted him, hustling inside the bar. Massimo frowned, his anxiety plain.
We're sorry to intrude this late. Not at all. Come in, both of you.
Beppe closed the door behind them, turning the sign on the door to Chiuso.
Thank you for coming to Aldo's funeral.
Of course. And you have our deepest condolences. Aldo was a wonderful young man. Massimo patted Beppe on the arm, and Beppe was thankful that Massimo was tactful enough not to mention the fight with Marco.
Please, sit down.
Beppe pulled chairs out from the nearest table. Massimo and Sandro sat down, and Marco came over carrying four glasses of red wine on a tray.
Buonasera.
Marco set the wine in front of them, then sat down. Massimo and Sandro greeted Marco, and Beppe could see that there was something weighing on Massimo's mind. His old friend took a big gulp of wine.
Massimo, what's the matter? I need your help. Then you shall have it, brother.
Absolutely, Marco added.
Massimo and Sandro seemed to ease, letting down their shoulders. Massimo met Beppe's eye.
You know about these new race laws, forbidding Jews from owning property or businesses?
Yes, and you know my view. They're a disgrace. I loathe our party's discriminatory laws. I don't countenance the persecution of Italian Jews, and it's the wrong direction for the party and for Italy.
Thank you for saying that. Sadly, the worst has happened. I was denied an exemption.
Oh, no.
Beppe recoiled, taken aback. He and Massimo had been reasonably certain that the Simones would get an exemption, and he certainly deserved one.
If we can't get this reversed, we'll be ruined. We'll lose the house and my practice.
Is there a way to appeal it?
None legally.
Massimo's forehead buckled.
I based my argument on my loyalty to the party. Remember the first day we met, when Sandra was born?
Yes, of course, I could never forget.
Beppe gestured outside the bar.
We met right there, on that spot. You had just left the hospital, having been there all night waiting for Gemma to deliver Sandro. We stood out front together. It was the March on Rome in 1922.
Massimo nodded, his eyes briefly shining.
Then we went to Piazza Venezia and saw Il Duce speak. The crowd was packed as far as the eye could see. You were already a member of the party.
Yes, I joined in 1919.
Beppe suppressed a pang. So much had changed since then, not for the better. Fascism had betrayed the Jews, and Mussolini had set the party on a course to war in alliance with Hitler. And now Aldo was gone, tainting Marco with suspicion of complicity.
There's an exemption to the race laws for fascists of the first hour, like you, those who joined from 1919 to 1922 and the second half of 1924.
I joined in 1923, though I was going to meetings from the earliest days. So you see, it's only a technicality that I was denied the exemption.
That's very true. I'll help you in any way I can. What can I do?
Beppe, you know so many people in the party. I was wondering if you could speak to someone and attest to my loyalty from those early days. I'm sure your word could make a difference.
Massimo turned to Marco.
And Marco, you work at the Fascio. I know you're well thought of there. Is there someone you could speak to for us as well? Commendatore Buonaccorso knows me, for as you remember, I introduced him to you. Perhaps you could remind him of my loyalty?
Of course, we'll talk to someone,
Beppe rushed to say, though the timing couldn't have been worse. He and Marco had no influence since Aldo's betrayal. But he couldn't tell Massimo and Sandro the truth about Aldo's death. It was confidential and shameful. Marco pursed his lips.
I'll ask too.
Massimo breathed with relief.
Thank you, both of you.
Sandro smiled.
Thank you so much.
Beppe patted Massimo on the arm.
Now let's have a drink to old friends.
To old friends.
Massimo raised his glass.
To old friends,
Marco said to Sandro, hoisting his wine.
Yes, to us,
Sandro said, after a moment. Chapter 45. Marco, November 1938. The next morning, Marco sat next to his father on a brocade bench outside Commendatore Buonaccorso's office. They had given the photograph of Aldo's blonde anti-fascist to Buonaccorso and had been told to wait here. That had been 2 hours ago, during which various fascist officers, whom Marco didn't recognize, hurried to and from the office. He perched on the edge of his seat, tense. His father was somber in the suit he had worn to Aldo's funeral. They had said barely a word to each other. Marco told himself to relax, but it was impossible. Everything was on the line today.
Gentlemen, an officer said, appearing from the office, Commendatore Buonaccorso will speak with you.
Thank you, Marco and his father answered in unison. They rose, entered the office, and gave the fascist salute, which Buonaccorso returned, then motioned to 2 cushioned chairs in front of his desk.
Please, gentlemen, sit down.
As they did, Buonaccorso took a seat behind his desk.
I'm surprised to see you here, Beppe.
I came to support Marco. Neither of us had any inkling of Aldo's shameful and traitorous activities. As Aldo's father, I should have known. If anyone is to blame, it is me. If anyone should be punished, punish me.
Marco looked over, touched at his father's words.
Papa, I'm responsible for myself.
His father ignored him, his attention on Buonaccorso.
We understand each other as veterans. I tell you, Marco's loyalty is as solid as mine. I trust that his production of the photograph will serve as proof.
Buonaccorso nodded curtly.
Beppe, I appreciate your words. We all know of your loyalty, your integrity. We understand now that neither of you had any idea of Aldo's treachery. Our friends in Ovra have the photograph and will investigate the woman. We feel satisfied that Marco was not collaborating with Aldo and the other anti-fascists.
Thank you. Then I assume that means he gets his job back at the Fascio?
Marco, startled, surprised at his father's boldness on his behalf.
Buonaccorso stroked his mustache, then turned to Marco.
Marco, yes, you have your job back. We shall let this unfortunate episode pass and not speak of it again.
Thank you, sir.
Marco smiled with relief.
You won't be sorry, sir.
His father interjected.
That I guarantee.
Thank you.
Buonaccorso glanced over as the door opened behind them, and Marco assumed someone had come in, as he smelled cigarette smoke.
One last thing, Commendatore,
his father said, raising a finger.
You know our mutual friend Massimo Simone. He has been denied an exemption from the new race laws, which I believe he is absolutely entitled. I'm sure you agree.
Denied, you say? Massimo?
Yes, and this injustice must be rectified. His exemption should be granted,
given his years of service and loyalty to the party. I vouch for him in every particular. I was hoping you would help him.
Buonaccorso shrugged.
Maybe I have no say in such matters, as much as I would like to help. It's outside the scope of my authority. I expected that was the case, so I wrote a letter on Massimo's behalf. I'm hoping that you will place it in the proper hands.
His father reached inside his jacket pocket, extracted an envelope, and set it on the desk.
I will, thank you.
Buonaccorso picked up the envelope, and just then, harsh laughter erupted from the back of the office. Marco and his father turned around as two uniformed OVRA officers walked to the desk, their black boots clicking on the parquet floor. Marco shuddered to recognize one of them as the bear-like OVRA officer who had interrogated him about Aldo. The other OVRA officer was short and skinny, holding a cigarette between slim fingers. Marco didn't know him, but he was casting hard eyes at his father.
"Do you remember me, Beppe?"
asked the skinny OVRA officer.
"Carmine Vecchio,"
his father answered matter-of-factly.
"Tell me, are you surprised to see me as a superior officer?"
"No officer is the superior of any trencherman."
Marco swallowed hard, as OVRA wasn't to be provoked.
"Bah!"
Officer Vecchio dragged on his cigarette.
"You haven't changed, you old war horse."
"Thank you,"
his father shot back, unsmiling.
"How dare you?"
Officer Vecchio snorted, and jets of smoke escaped his nostrils.
"You should show me some respect, and also my fellow officer Stefano Pretriani."
He gestured to the bear-like officer, who didn't react.
"And by the way, you're in no position to ask favors for your Jew friends."
Marco's father didn't blink.
"It's not a favor when it's deserved. Massimo Simone is a loyal fascist. He served our country and—"
"What do you know about loyalty, Beppe? Your son Aldo was running guns for subversives right under your nose. God knows what Marco's really up to."
Marco jumped to his feet on impulse. "I am loyal to this party, and so is Massimo Simone. He deserves that exemption." His father rose beside him, more calmly, his gaze on Vecchio.
"Carmine, you're still picking unnecessary fights, and I'm still ignoring you."
"What fight is unnecessary, Beppe? Was Caporetto? Is that why you ran like a coward?"
"I did no such thing.
Prove it.
I don't have to prove anything to you.
You Terrizzis, don't fool me. I'll be watching you every minute. I'm keeping my eye on both of you."
"Enjoy the view."
His father turned his back and walked out with Marco behind him. They left the office, crossed the anteroom, and strode past the guards. They descended the grand marble staircase, side by side, roughly the same height and build, unmistakably father and son. But after what had just happened, Marco wondered if he knew less about his father than he had thought. They reached the ground floor, strode through the archway, and left Palazzo Braschi. They stopped in order to part ways in Piazza Navona, crowded with people rushing this way and that.
"I'm going back to work."
His father's eyes went flinty in the sunshine.
"I'll stay here," Marco said, newly awkward.
In other circumstances, he would have hugged his father, grateful for the help in getting his job back. But the rift between them made that impossible. "By the way, how do you know Carmine Vecchio?"
"It doesn't matter."
"Do you think the Simones will get the exemption?"
"They should. I paid plenty."
"What do you mean?" Marco asked, surprised.
"What did you think was in that envelope, son?"
Chapter 46. Massimo. 21st November, 1938. Massimo sat in his study, his head in his hands. On the desk in front of him was yet another set of race laws. By today's royal decree, he was no longer a member of the fascist party. He had been thrown out. He reread the law's main provision, hoping that the sentences would change. Nevertheless, they remained the same, in black and white print. Italian citizens who, according to the laws, are considered as belonging to the Jewish race are excluded from the PNF, the Partito Nazionale Fascista. Massimo couldn't comprehend what was before his eyes. He was a lawyer baffled by a law. The fascists had betrayed him, even though he and other Jews had helped put Il Duce in power. Massimo had believed in Il Duce, even loved him, but Il Duce had betrayed him too. The newspapers were calling it a purge of Jews. The door to his study was closed, and Massimo could hear Gemma and Sandro talking in the kitchen. The law had upset them, but hadn't devastated them the way it did him. He didn't know who he was if he wasn't a fascist. The party was more than politics to him. It was a rubric like the law itself, a system of orderly government that allowed men to achieve their fullest potential. He thought back to the March on Rome, the beginning of the party's rise. It was only 16 years ago. He had ties as old as that, shoes even. It was the year Sandro was born, and Massimo had felt so much hope back then, a new father to a new son, witnessing a new father to his beloved country. He had believed that his life and times had converged in a wonderfully auspicious way, especially as a Roman. He had expected the future to shine bright and glorious. His gaze wandered around his study, with his framed diplomas and bookshelf filled with tax regulations and textbooks. They were artifacts of his past life as a tax lawyer, like a fragment of a marble column at the Roman Forum. He had become a ruin. He caught sight of his reflection in the window. He looked haunted, and he felt so. He thought again of the exemption he had failed to obtain. If he had succeeded, he would still be a party member. But he had let himself and his family down. He prayed that Beppe and Marco could make the difference. Part 3. Nessun maggior dolore che ricordarsi del tempo felice nella miseria. There is no sorrow greater than in times of misery to hold at heart the memory of happiness. Dante Alighieri, Inferno, Canto 5, 121 through 123.
Chapter 47. Elisabetta, July 1939. Elisabetta and Nonna had a nightly routine, sharing a nightcap of anisette, a sweet anise liqueur. Challenging times were upon them, as rumors of impending war were on everyone's lips. Business had taken a bad turn at Casa Servano, since the tourist trade was down and Trastevere Jews had been harmed by the race laws, which the Trasteverini regarded as an abomination. Elisabetta thought of Sandro all the time, heartbroken that he didn't love her anymore. She loved him still and wept at night, missing him and worrying about him. She avoided Marco, not to lead him on now that she knew Sandro was the one. Luckily, Marco had gotten busier at Palazzo Braschi. Ugh, what a dreadful day. Nonna eased into her chair at the head of the walnut table, where an overhead lamp of milky Murano glass emitted a halo of light. The window was open, but the breeze was warm and barely moved the lace curtains. Via Fiorata was typically quiet at night, and the only sound was Rico purring on the cushioned chair atop the doily that protected it from his cat hair. His eyes were closed and his paws tucked under him, his tummy full of branzino scraps.
Things will get better, Nonna. Not before they get worse, girl.
Elisabetta sipped anisette from a tiny carved glass, which was one of hundreds that Nonna owned. It turned out that the old woman collected all manner of glassware and myriad sets of antique china, as well as brake fronts, credenzas, and display cabinets to store the collection. The cabinetry lined every room in the small, cheery house, set cheek by jowl displaying stacked sets of Royal Doulton, Limoges, Majolica, Capodimonte, Minton, and other China manufacturers. It was somewhat eccentric, but it made the house feel surprisingly homey. There was a knock, and Elisabetta rose, crossed the living room, and opened the door to find Marco in uniform, with a grin on his face and a large, gaily wrapped box under his arm.
Buonasera, Elisabetta.
Marco swept her up with his free arm and kissed her on the cheek.
What a surprise, Elisabetta said, flustered. It's good to see you. Elisabetta, where are your manners?
Nonna called out.
Who's there? Why don't you invite him in?
Marco, please come in. Elisabetta opened the door wider, and Marco entered the living room, eyeing the array of cabinetry without comment. She showed him into the dining room.
Nonna, this is Marco Terizzi, and Marco, this is Signora Servano.
Nonna's hooded eyes narrowed.
Doesn't your father, Beppe, run Bar Girosport?
Yes, Marco smiled pleasantly.
Aren't you the one who serenaded Elisabetta at my restaurant?
Yes, Marco nodded.
So, you're courting Elisabetta?
Yes, Marco beamed.
What are your intentions? Are they honorable or trifling?
Elisabetta cringed. Nonna! Marco straightened.
My intentions are honorable, and I love her.
Elisabetta felt moved, her heart responding to her own surprise.
Nonna scowled. But you're not a very diligent suitor, are you, Marco?
He blinked.
Pardon me. You haven't been here yet, have you? She's been here a while. Did you know?
Yes, but I've had to work.
So, why do you come knocking at this hour?
I had to work late and...
You don't expect she's going out with you tonight, do you?
Beh, I was hoping we could get a gelato.
Don't you know she has to work in the morning? Do you believe you can just show up and have it your way?
No, I don't.
Don't get any ideas, capito? You know she's a good girl, don't you? She's not like the others. Do you understand?
I know she's not like the others.
So why treat her as you do? If your intentions are honorable, why come by so late, for the very first time?
Elisabetta wished she could flee, but Nonna was unstoppable, already waving at Marco's wrapped gift.
Anyway, what have you got there?
Oh, this is for her. Marco slid the gift from under his arm.
You don't think you can buy her off, do you? Elisabetta, why don't you open your gift?
I will. Elisabetta was too mortified to meet Marco's eye as he handed her the present.
Thank you, Marco. What's the occasion?
If I tell you, then you'll know what.
Basta! Nonna interrupted with a snort. Talk, talk, talk. I'm sleepy. Hurry up.
Elisabetta burst into laughter, and so did Marco. She tore off the silvery paper, and he balled it up as she lifted the lid of the box and opened a layer of white tissue paper.
Nonna craned her neck. How can I see? Why don't you hold it up?
Elisabetta gasped when she opened the tissue paper, to reveal a beautiful pink dress, sleeveless with a scoop neckline, its fabric a filmy chiffon with a pink satin ribbon at the waist. She lifted it up, and it felt lighter than air, made for a night she would never have, for a life she would never live. A dress so elegant, feminine, and fancy that it was fit for a princess, not a waitress.
Nonna scoffed. Now where's she going to wear that?
Nonna, please. Elisabetta clasped the dress to her chest, overwhelmed.
Thank you so much, Marco. This is a beautiful dress.
You're welcome.
Marco smiled warmly, his dark eyes shining.
I've been invited to a fancy party, and I was wondering if you would go with me. You can wear the dress.
What about shoes?
Nonna interjected again. You think she has shoes for such a dress? Or do you expect her to go barefoot?
Nonna, I'll get my own shoes.
Elisabetta's heart was still hurting from Sandro, but a fancy party sounded fun, and she hadn't had fun in such a long time, working every day and going to bed early every night.
Marco touched her arm. Will you go with me, Elisabetta?
Yes,
Elisabetta answered impulsively.
That's enough,
Nonna glowered, pointing to the door. Good night, Marco.
Bye-bye. Sleep tight.
Marco chuckled. Good night, Signora Servano.
Elisabetta placed the dress back in the box, folding it with care and smoothing out the skirt.
Marco, I'll walk you to the door.
No, you won't.
Nonna waved her hand.
Marco, see yourself to the door, will you? That's not difficult, is it? Are you sighted, in full possession of locomotive power?
Signora Servano, yes, thank you. Good night, Elisabetta.
Marco reached for Elisabetta's hand and kissed it softly, then strode to the door and left. Elisabetta felt her heart wake up, though she hadn't known it was sleeping. Marco did love her. And she felt herself wanting what he was offering, whether it was fun, romance, or true love, she wasn't sure. She knew only that she felt happy. She looked at Nonna, but the old woman was frowning.
Nonna, what's the matter? Don't you like him?
Not for you, Nonna shot back, lifting an eyebrow. I told you before, you can't be with him.
But why not? Elisabetta asked, mystified. Why don't you like him for me?
Nonna's expression softened to sadness.
Sit down, dear.
Chapter 48. Sandro, July 1939. Sandro hurried home as soon as he heard that yet another race law had been issued, restricting Jewish employment in scores of professions, including doctors. Sandro feared that his mother had lost her job, since Jews without exemptions had to be listed in special rosters, elenchi speciali, and their professional practice was limited exclusively to Jewish clients. His mother worked at Ospedale Fate Bene Fratelli, a Catholic hospital, and Sandro doubted that they had sufficient Jewish patients to justify keeping her on. Sandro hustled through the ghetto, past shopkeepers huddling over newspapers and distraught housewives clustered in teary groups. So many Jews had lost their jobs that the streets were lined with beggars, rag traders, and the newly poor selling their possessions. Via del Portico d'Ottavia had gone from a thoroughfare bustling with happy families to a marketplace of despair. Stores had closed, and the butcher shop struggled, since kosher butchering had been prohibited under a set of race laws designed to prevent Jews from practicing their religion. Jewish periodicals had been ordered to cease publication, and intermarried Jews sought exemptions to define themselves as Gentile. Congregations diminished as Jews emigrated, and rabbis emigrated too. The fascist barrage of discriminatory laws, intended to exclude Jews from daily life and drive them from Italy, was doing its dirty work. Suddenly, Sandro realized he was going in the wrong direction, as his feet kept carrying him to their old house on Piazza Mattei. They had never gotten their exemption reversed, so his father's law practice had been shuttered, and they had lost their house. They had moved into a smaller apartment in a lesser house that had a dingy gray facade cracked like many others on the street, squalid compared with the refined Piazza Mattei. Sandro reached the house, ran up the broken steps to the third floor, and opened the door to their new apartment. The air was stifling, and he dropped his rucksack on the floor of the cramped kitchen that doubled as a living and dining room. They used the living room for his parents' bedroom, and Sandro got a bedroom barely big enough for a bed. It might have been close quarters, but at least it was sunny, since its back window faced south.
"Mom, I heard the news. Did the hospital fire you?"
Sandro went to his parents at the kitchen table, their expressions somber.
"Yes,"
his mother answered quietly. Her eyes were reddish and puffy, and her face had fallen into resigned lines. She had on her gray linen dress and pearls, managing to look like her dignified self, though her heart must be breaking.
"I'm so sorry."
Sandro gave her a hug, then sat down at the small wooden table. They had sold most of the other furniture, except for a bookshelf stuffed with Sandro's math books, Rosa's first edition novels, and his parents' old textbooks, and all of their valuables, except for a brake front containing their family menorah and silver candlesticks. His mother paused, pursing her lips.
"When the news came out, I had just delivered a beautiful baby girl, a big one, too."
His mother swallowed.
"It's hard to accept that it's over, just like that. I've worked there such a long time. I loved what I did. I love the labor and delivery nurses. They're a very special group."
"I know," Sandro nodded, having heard her say so many times.
"And I feel terrible that my patients won't have a female doctor anymore. The first-time mothers, mainly. They feel more comfortable with me. I regret that I won't be there to help them."
Sandro knew that as a woman, she had struggled against discrimination by the other doctors.
"Were all the Jewish doctors fired?"
"Yes."
"In the other departments, too?"
"Yes, a lot of us."
"Even before the effective date,"
his father interjected, shaking his head. He had on his customary suit and tie, but his lapels looked worn.
"I don't blame the administrators," his mother added with a sigh. "They had no choice. They have to follow the law. Giancarlo told me they hated to do it, and Mauro cried when I picked up my discharge papers. Alberto took me and the others for coffee afterward. Sister Anna Domenica and the other nurses broke down and cried."
Sandro knew them all. He had met most of his mother's colleagues when he would stop by the hospital after school.
"I blame myself."
His father raked a hand through his hair.
"If I had gotten us the exemption, you could have kept your job, Gemma. I should have gotten it for us. I deserved it. We deserve it."
"You tried your best, and so did Beppe. We did all we could."
"Not true."
His father shook his head.
"You know what I hear? There are rumors that some are bribing their way to exemptions, that there's a racket being run by the Undersecretary of the Interior, Buffarini. He's a virulent anti-Semite, but he's fine with taking our money."
He shook his head again.
"I let you down, dear."
"You didn't, Massimo. There's no guarantee, even with a bribe."
"It's all my fault, all of it. I relied on reason, law, justice. I still can't believe they denied me."
Listening, Sandro began to worry about his father, who had changed after being ousted from the party, becoming melancholy. All the time his father brought up his failure to get an exemption, second-guessing himself over and over again. Lately his father had even begun carrying a folder of notes to an almost compulsive degree. As Sandro knew he would, his father opened it and began to read aloud, even now.
"Here's the latest exemptions granted so far, which prove my point. According to the last census, 3,502 Jewish families were entitled to an exemption. That's broken down as
406 families of those killed in action, 721 from families that were volunteers, 1,597 from families of those decorated with military valor, and 3 families of fascist martyrs. His father ran a fingernail across a line of his handwritten notes. But here we go. As of today, 724 families of veteran fascists were granted exemptions, of which we should have been one. We should have been. It could have been us so easily if the interpretation hadn't been so strict. His mother sighed. We did our best, and even without my job we're not destitute. We still have our savings and the bonds they gave us when they took the house. Right, Sandro nodded, relieved. Under the laws, the deed to their old house had been transferred to a special government office, Egeli, and in return, his parents had been given 30-year bonds. The transaction was a poor bargain, since the bonds weren't for fair market value and didn't gain maturity for 30 years.
Massimo, don't worry.
His mother put an arm around his father's shoulders. We have enough to keep us fed for a year, and perhaps by then this nightmare will have passed. You handle the money, so you know better than I do. Gemma, there's something I have to tell you. His father's lined face blanched. We don't have as much as you think we do. We have less than half.
What do you mean?
His mother frowned in bewilderment. Sandro felt his stomach drop, but didn't interrupt.
Beh, it's hard to explain.
His father began riffling through his papers.
I keep an accounting of the money I've withdrawn over time. It's in here somewhere.
What?
His mother recoiled, horrified.
You've been withdrawing money from our account? What for?
I've been giving out loans at the synagogue.
To whom?
His mother's eyes flew open behind her glasses.
I loaned it to my clients, until they get the exemption, or in case they don't.
His father kept riffling through his papers, and his words began to speed up, rushing over one another.
Gemma, there are so many people worse off than we are, and when I'm sitting face to face with them, knowing we have more than they, I extend a helping hand. It's as the Torah says. It's tzedakah, righteous giving, charity, and justice that we should share what we have, and I assumed you would agree.
But they'll never be able to repay it. Nobody has a job anymore.
I didn't anticipate that you would lose your job, and even so, we should have gotten the exemption. That's the thing. It was an injustice. I can show you on our original application,
Massimo. You shouldn't have given away money or lent it when there's talk of war. If that happens, we will need every penny.
Listen, both of you. Sandro stood up, and a new sense of calm came over him. We can't look to the past. Papa, you can't keep bringing up our exemption. Mamma, maybe he shouldn't have lent the money, but it's gone now. We have to start over, going forward.
His mother moaned, stricken. But we don't have enough to live on.